Again, this week, we've been keenly reminded that we cannot live in this world without adversity. And nearly always, as we see it in the Bible many times, and if you look at your own life and the lives of people that you know that have lived faithfully before the Lord, nearly always adversity is at the same time opportunity. Adversity is not adversity alone. Adversity is an open door. It's an opportunity. I received a call from a desperate young man this week who was crying on the other end of the phone. He was very, very sad. And after all, he made a comment. He said, "Do you know where I am, Brother Dale? I am stuck in God's waiting room." I said, "You read the door wrong when you went in there. It says God's opportunity room." Did you get that? I said, if I would be in God's waiting room this morning, son, here's what I would do. I would find the door that goes into his office, take my chair over there, get as close to that as I can, and that's where you would find me. Get as close as you can. Adversity. So how does faith respond to life's adversity? I doubt if there's anybody here that has lived without adversity. Some of you suffered terribly with things that have happened, things that you're experiencing. How do we respond to life's adversity? During this past week, I was in contact with at least five different situations where the adversity in these people's lives is overwhelming. And there seems for each one of them to be no relief whatsoever, no answer, no resolve. And I'm not referring here to the sudden loss that happened at Pulaski. I'm not referring to that in what I say today. And adversity, this kind of adversity in the lives of the people I was with this past week and relating to, this adversity is compounded with this additional weight. In each case, in these five cases, there seems to be injustice. Life has not been fair. Those we should have trusted, as the Bible says, have lifted up their heel against us. And that greatly increases the burden. When the adversity we're facing, the unresolved problems we face, are partly caused, at least, by people we should have depended on. In some cases, this conflict of heart has gone on for many years. In some cases, it has been caused by a church, by pastors in that church. Often such sorrow is inflicted by one's own family, but the effect is always the same. It's too often the same. I don't want it to ever be this way, but it's too often this way. And here's how we end up thinking. Look at what the board says up there. If no one will undertake to solve this and set the record straight, it will then be up to me to do it. That's how people eventually think. No one else is helping me. No one else is getting this thing straightened out. I've carried this weight for a long time. It's up to me to take care of it. I will do it. And that response, that attitude, with that attitude, the problem is now bigger than ever. You've heard before from this pulpit that far more important than the difficulty that we're facing in life, the extenuating circumstances that we cannot control, far more difficult, far more important than all that, is our response to it. We are far more worn out, depleted, frustrated by a wrong response to life's problems than we are by the problems themselves. In fact, though it seems almost impossible for me to stand here and say this, I think it can be proven many times over, though not as many people have experienced it as should have experienced it, But a proper response to life's adversity is not only an opportunity, but something happens to the problem when my attitude is right. Just, I've got to face that. Something happens to that problem when my attitude is what it should be. When my heart is at the right place. So there's a title written up there on the board. And there's a staff. When my wife was still able to walk, she had trouble walking even when we first moved here. And someone here in this county made a staff for my wife. It is very smoothly done. It's a beautiful piece of wood. It has a rubber on the bottom so it doesn't slip on the pathway or on the road or sidewalk. I thought of bringing that along this morning, but I chose not to. I didn't want to stand up here and swing that thing around. But there's a staff in your hand. And I'm going to speak this morning about that staff in your hand, and there's more than one thing you can do with it. Let's just open our Bibles to Numbers chapter 20. I'm going to read just verses 10 and 11. There's a whole lot we could read here. I'll read verse 9 with it. And Moses took the rod from before the people. It says rod here instead of staff. It's the same word. And Moses took the rod from before the Lord as he commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the congregation together before the rock. And he said unto them, hear now, ye rebels, must we fetch you water out of this rock? And Moses lifted up his hand, and with his rod he smote the rock twice. And the water came out abundantly, and the congregation drank, and their beasts also. But something happened that will never be repaired. Something happened here that is not God's will. Would you go over to 1 Samuel chapter 17? And this will help add to what that children's lesson was about this morning. 1 Samuel 17, we'll read verse 45 here. Then said David to the Philistine, thou comest to me with a sword, and with a spear, with a shield. But I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. This day will God deliver thee into my hand, and I will smite thee. When it tells him here what he's going to do with him. Now if you go to verse 49, it says, David put his hand in his bag and took thence a stone. He had chosen 5 smooth stones and slung it and smote the Philistine in the forehead. David could have done something else with those stones, those 5 smooth stones that he put into his bag. You see what he did here. He didn't do it by himself. He didn't give himself any credit for what he did. He didn't tell this giant that this is what, this is, I'm so capable, you're going to soon find out who you're dealing with. It was God who was capable. Goliath was dealing with God. Let's just stop there. In the adversity you're facing, is the adversity yours alone to take care of? Or is there a God in heaven that's concerned about that problem? Many times this response that we give to life's adversity is a characteristic evidence that we don't believe there's any God around. If I don't take care of this thing, it's not going to be done. And we act as if we have no partnership, we have no fellowship with God. This is all up to me to deal with. Genesis 39, verse 19. Genesis 39:19. And it came to pass when his master heard the words of his wife, which he spake unto him, saying, after this manner did thy servant unto me, that his wrath was kindled. And Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were bound, and he was there in the prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. Adversity. How does faith respond to life's adversity? Chapter 41, verse 38. And Pharaoh said unto his servants, can we find such a one as this is, a man in whom the Spirit of God is? 13 years of adversity. 13 years without support. 13 years with no help. And everything that happened throughout those 13 years was a step further away from what Joseph would have wanted to experience, what any of us would have wanted to have. You see, the staff, the rod in our hand, can either be God's or it can be mine. The stones in the bag can be God's instrument or they can be my attempted effort. Either God is with me in this impossible situation or else I am in it alone. All adversity, no matter what kind it is, causes suffering to everybody that has it. All adversity, whatever kind it may be. We see that in Joseph. But may I add something to you? If that adversity is causing suffering for you, God is suffering too. The secret is, and listen very closely, you can easily miss this. The secret is, what is causing God to suffer? You don't need to turn to this beautiful verse, but it's so powerful. I quoted it to somebody on the phone yesterday. These words are spoken of God. They're found in the book of Isaiah. Listen to what this says. And where I use the word adversity this morning, this verse has the word affliction instead of adversity, but I think you'll get the point. In all their affliction, he was afflicted. That he there is God. In all their affliction, he was afflicted, and the angel of his presence saved them, and his love and his pity, he redeemed them, and he bare them and carried them all the days of old. In their affliction, he was afflicted. But something is causing God to suffer. What is it? It is either our suffering that grieves our Father God, or maybe it is our wrong response to it that makes him grieve more. It's worth meditating on. That takes some meditation there to understand that. Now, I was on the phone with a man yesterday. I've known this man for over 20 years. He has faced his difficulties for nearly that length of time, not quite all of it, over 15 years. One of the most difficult things I've ever worked with in my lifetime, I think. He doesn't live here in Tennessee. He's certainly not from Grace Fellowship here. This man was on the phone screaming, blaming his wife. She's demon-possessed. She was never born again. Staff hit the rock, not two times. The staff kept hitting the rock. What does God think when he sees that staff of ours hitting the rock? A brother, if you're going to overcome sister, the adversity in your life, we have to try it another way. Until that stops, until that talk about his wife stops, until there's a change of heart towards her, there's no answer for that problem. I could give you the names of preachers, and some of you would know some of them, who have lost hope when working with that person will have nothing to do with it. They will not answer a phone call. They will not respond to a letter. They're wore out with the futility of trying to do anything. I know of one preacher that still has not put his receiver down on the phone, hit the off button on the face of the telephone. And that one is not quite sure what to do next. So I'm going to ask two questions this morning and try to answer them. Why? There's the first question. Why does this anxious load press down your weary mind? That's the words of a hymn. It's in your songbook right in front of you there. It's number 335. I think it might be the third stanza. It might be the second or third. It says, why does this anxious load press down your weary mind? Haste to the Heavenly Father's throne and rich refreshment find. That's what the song says. We can sing it, we won't. And the answer to the question, why does this anxious load press down your weary mind, is this answer. The answer is, I cannot trust God. I am not living by faith. I can handle this better on my own. I've waited on God long enough. It is high time that something be done. So we take this situation into our own hands and we grab that rod, that staff. It's time for something to happen here. It's time for someone to find out who I am. It's time for the Word to realize that I'm not who you think I am. I have this thing under control. No, you don't. All of your efforts will fail. Nothing good will come out of those attempts. What does God think when he sees me strike the rock? And Moses said, ye rebels. And Moses said, must we get water out of this rock for you? Is that what we must do? And the rock was smitten, dear people, this morning, not only twice with a rod, but the rock was smitten by the carnal anger of the man who held that stick. In your life, in my life, irritation, frustration, this whole sentence, I have had enough. I can stand no more. And you can look at the wrong responses that our impatience attempts. Saul offered sacrifices when he should not have. He could not wait any longer. He had to get this done. It's up to him. He's going to fix it. And the terrible results that came to his kingdom, his children, because of that impatient response, it's going to happen now, and I'm going to see to it that it happens. He took that rod and smote this thing. He didn't have a rod in his hand, but you understand the illustration by this time. Hear Martha's complaint against Mary. She was out in the kitchen. Mary was somewhere else. I'm going to ask you a question this morning. Are you sure that complaint was against Mary? Was perhaps that complaint against Christ himself? And we find ourselves doing that. She just got overwhelmed with it. It was too much. It just, breaking point. It's this. And it spilled over. It wasn't my cup runneth over either. But it spilled over. And yours does too. And so does mine. You get those points of desperation. And there's no God around. And there's no trust in the Lord. And here we are with that rod. And the frustration boils over. Shall we call fire down from heaven and destroy these Samaritans? You see that rod beating against the rock. If we would examine the attitude we have towards those who have wronged us, we might get a clear picture of how God feels about us and what he sees in us. And there are many ways for us to strike the rock with that staff in our hands. Some people make all kinds of phone calls. I know one man who spends so much time on the telephone that his work suffers. He can hardly get his jobs out that he's trying to work on that people have asked him to do. On the phone, on the phone, on the phone, telling the story, retelling the story, retelling the story. And there's a purpose behind each one of those phone calls. If you would ask why that phone call was made, it wouldn't take you very long to figure out what the reason for that was. Some write letters, send emails all around the country. You try to surround yourself with those who agree with you, who are going to see it the way you see it. And it gives a sense of euphoria, a sense of camaraderie, a sense of teammanship to know that others see it like I see it. But when I'm in this shape, let me tell you what happens. Those people that I feel are on my team can do nothing at all to help me. They're making my problem worse. We use all kinds of ways to smite that rock with a stick. We collect all the evidence we can of mistakes that others make. I know one man who struggles with a church, struggles with his, he had difficulty with that congregation, with its ministers, and so they were going to have a members' meeting or a brothers' meeting, and so he went into that room where the brothers' meeting was and set up a loudspeaker, a recording system. I didn't say it right. Put a device there to record that whole thing, and when it was over, he went in, snuck in there, got it back out, played it. Oh, this person said that, and that one said that. He had evidence of it recorded here. So be careful what you say to brothers being Berlin. Can you imagine how hard that rock smote, was smitten, when someone does that? And if that's our view towards God's people, towards authority, towards a holy thing, like trying to sit together to work on difficulties and problems and figure something out, if that's our attitude towards that, where is God in a case like that? I'm using illustrations that come from a great distance from here because I don't want to say anything that gives you an indication where this comes from. It certainly doesn't come from Cannon County nor Tennessee. Although this happens in Cannon County, it happens in Tennessee. So now we have proof. Now we have proof in our hands. See this evidence that I've got. I'm going to ask you one more question. You have proof of what? You have proof of your uncanny ability to do research. But what more proof do you have? It will not do you a bit of good. If we do not trust God in our difficulty, in our adversity, regardless of what that adversity might be, here's what happens. We don't trust God. We don't trust the church. We don't trust our brothers. We don't trust a pastor. There's one left. We trust Dale. We trust ourselves. And my use of the rod. I have confidence in that. I have trust there. I've lost confidence everywhere else, but I still have it here. I knew a young preacher that found himself out of fix with his congregation, with his constituency, his congregational affiliation. He decided to go off to another distant place and go start a church all over again by himself. I was living in Costa Rica. He wrote me a letter to ask me what I thought of his idea. I wrote back to him and I told him, "Brother, you have lost confidence in the church there, and that church happened to be nationwide fellowship churches. You've lost confidence in your congregation. I could tell you where that was, but I won't. But you don't have any, you have tremendous confidence in yourself. And I feel that the greatest suspicion you should have is for yourself and not for others. And I told him there's only one way that his congregation will succeed where he's trying to start one in a new place. And that is for him to invest confidence in someone else and ask them to come there and provide some oversight and submit to their direction and do what they say, listen to their teaching, allow them to have the last word in those decisions. Follow that, and your course will be blessed. Until you do that, it will fail. He did what I said. And that church soon grew and grew and grew and became a very, very influential congregation. But this confidence in ourselves, I can do it, nobody else can. Our exasperation and emotional exhaustion are obvious proof of our futile efforts. Why art thou cast down, O my soul? And why art thou disquieted within me? And why this frustration and exasperation? Why am I so frustrated? Why am I so exhausted? I can't stand this anymore. Do you know what's wrong? The Bible tells us we cease from our own works. And Jesus said, come and find rest for your souls. There's something seriously wrong. And the problem is not the problem. It's not the adversity itself. As difficult and real as that is, I'm admitting that it's real. I'm admitting that many people are unjustly and unfairly handled. I'm admitting that many difficulties have come out of churches. I'm admitting that you may have been very easily, and I'm sorry, but hurt. By an elder, by a bishop, by a congregational board, whatever, whatever. I could give you many illustrations of that. Not in your life, but in my own. But why the exhaustion? Our lack of faith in God to minister to these needs that are physical, they're natural things, they're things that have happened, they're things that have happened here in life's experience. And God can't deal with it. God doesn't know what he's doing. God isn't able. I will pick up that rod. Well, then I'll ask you a question. Where did you ever get this idea that God can take care of your spiritual needs? Why don't you save yourself? Why don't you pick up your rod and save yourself? Why don't you save yourself from your sins? Why don't we get this great salvation? Why don't we find a way to redeem ourselves? I mean, surely there must be something religious that you can do that'll put you in tremendous standing with eternity. But you can't. You're helpless. And yet God will not do it without your surrender. God will not do it without you turning that over to him. Without saying, I've tried, this is a mess I have made. I'm going to tell you a story that's an embarrassment for me to tell you, but you won't get the point. This important point I'm making now, you won't get it unless I give you a story to go with it. And so the idea is that you cannot handle this difficult thing that you're facing in life. You cannot handle it yourself. No more than what you can save your own soul from sin and death. But you won't let God do it. Because there's a problem between you and God. That's why. So we're in Vermont. We just got there. We moved there in 1966. That's just about the snow belt, the snow capital of the United States. I've seen 4 feet of snowfall just at one time. When it stopped snowing, there was 4 feet of snow on the ground. You had a shovel, your way out of your house and your car out of the garage or out of the driveway just about every day. We worked night shift. We had to be there 11 o'clock at night. I tried to get the car out so we could go to the assignment. Me to the emergency room, my wife to the psych ward. And we couldn't get this car to go. Snow over the place, we couldn't get the car to go. I couldn't get it out onto the road where I put Suzanne behind the wheel, and I told her when to put on the gas and when to let off, and I was trying to push, and this car went nowhere, and I was frustrated to no end, and I was hollering at my wife, and she had the window down, it was cold, and she was trying to listen to what I was telling her, and everything I said, she did it wrong, turned this way, she turned the wrong way, now throttle, now no throttle, no, she couldn't get it, and I was working this girl, and she couldn't get this car to go, and I couldn't get it out of the snow. Then I noticed that over here, side of a street, there were two men talking on a porch. And the one lifted up his voice and said, "Sir, if you'd stop hollering to your wife and give us a chance, we'd take care of your car in a short time." And I bowed my heart right there. I was so ashamed. It was terrible. And I thanked those men for what they did, and the car was soon on the road. And those two men in this story represent God in your life. Until we stop this swinging with that staff, I wasn't beating the car. I wasn't beating the snow. I was beating my wife. Or else I was beating God. But we were getting nowhere with that frustration. And you can't do it spiritually. Why do you think you can handle, why should this anxious load bear down that weary mind? You can't take care of it. You can't make it happen. You can try all you want to. It's way beyond your power. It's way beyond my own. Our lack of faith in God is what's wrong. And God is waiting on us to see our selfish and faithless way of responding to this adversity. God would certainly want to do something about it, but he's waiting on us. And I'm not trying by these words to minimize the weight of the burden placed upon you. It is very, very real. It is and it has been in my own life. I understand what 3 years of drought can do to a dairy farm. I'll give you a suggestion. When you have 3 years of drought in a dairy farm, you buy yourself a bigger sprinkling can. Go out there and water the corn rows and the hay field. There's nothing you can do about it. Not when you're on the Bullpen Creek in Tennessee. I know what it's like to be silenced from the ministry 3 times. Take your stick and beat if you want to. Hit something. Who do you hit? The church building? The bishop? Who do you hit? The church members that went along with it? Who do you hit when you're silenced from the ministry? Who do you hit with your rod when there's a death in your family? 7 weeks after you move to a new country. Who do you hit when you find a congregation at last that your family enjoys attending and it looks like they could provide a spiritual haven for you and they tell you that no, you are not welcome here. You'll never become a member of our church. You are out of here. Take your stick and beat. Who are you going to hit? Shame and ridicule from an embarrassing struggle that I had in my boyhood. I've seen all kinds of injustice in the name of the church and in the name of her dogma. I've seen a lot of it. What effect does this have on me? When so much is against me, others are against me, and life is unfair. What happens to me? I'm going to give you 3 things that happen to many people, and I'm very, very sorry to say these awful words. But all of you sitting here that are 10 years of age or older have seen what I'm going to say. And I have this against me, and this was unfair, and it never should have happened, but I have this rod, but I don't have God. May I tell you something about that rod that you've got in your hand? Do you know that that rod made of wood? Do you know that rod has a whole stack of Egyptian snakes inside that rod? Sometimes the snakes come out when God should come out. I become critical. I become cynical. And I become skeptical. I'm just going to talk about those three words just briefly. This will take only about 60 seconds. I want you to listen to this. I become critical. I become controlling. I become condemning. Yes, I have knowledge. Yes, I have a certain belief system. Yes, I have a lifestyle. Yes, I have a form. But no life in Dale. No healing. No spiritual help for anyone else. I can be critical as can be. I can't fix anything. I have nothing of life to offer to anyone. Cynical. What does that mean? Pessimistic. Distrustful of others and their motives. A cynical person trusts only himself. Skeptical. An attitude of doubt towards others. Doubt towards God. Doubt towards the brotherhood. Unable to accept the truth of a matter. Uncertainty in my heart. And this cloud in the heart is cast as a dense fog upon other people. These traits destroy the spirit of peace. And this spirit reproduces itself in the life of others. And it's one of the reasons why I have so much difficulty in this adversity, because I now have more people turned against me than I had before. Life is unfair for many of us, but can I find my rest in God? And so I'm just, that was describing the problem. Now I want to look at the answer. As we're going through this adversity, what can we do? What is the right way to respond to it? I ask another question. What can God do? And how do we respond while we wait? If you're in God's waiting room, how do you respond while you're waiting? I could ask you this question. Is God right now involved in your present distress? Is he for you or is he against you? And I told someone on the phone yesterday why it is that many people think in their adversity and their struggles in life, why they think God is against them. And I'm going to say this to you this morning. The reason why many of us feel that in this difficulty we're facing, God is against us instead of for us is because we know how wrong we are. We know the things we've done we shouldn't have done. And we feel that God has every right to punish us, and so we cannot depend upon God's help because he's the very one that's doing this whole thing. He's the one that's causing this mess. He's the one that's... Didn't God cause the drought? Does Jesus care when I tried and failed to resist some temptation strong? Did you ever hear that? Did any of you ever hear that? You know, if you could believe in your sin, in your mistake, in your failure, in the struggles you have in life where it went down, it went the wrong way, and you feel guilty and you feel ashamed and you wonder how many other people noticed it and how many other people thought of it. If you at that very, very low moment could say, yes, Jesus cares that I tried and failed to resist some temptation strong. Yes, he cares that I cannot handle this thing. Yes, he cares that I was too weak and I made another serious mistake and added to the load and made it worse than it was before. Yes, he cares. What would you do if you believed that? Where would you go if you believed that? What direction would you take in life if that's what you believed? Because there's an answer right there. Can we live by faith? Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. You see, living by faith means that we live by believing and not by seeing. We don't see God's answer to the problem. We don't see God's answer to the drought. We don't see God's answer to getting in your car and driving away from the church meeting after you were silenced from the ministry, you don't see what the future's going to be. You don't see how God's going to take care of that. When the five ministers stand at the door when you walked in here with your family of four children, and they told you on that Sunday morning that you will not be received as members in this church. We cannot have you here. And you don't see the future after you hear those words. And those things ring in your ears. You don't know what to do about it. You've got teenagers. They'd love to be in that church. They're out. May I pause here and tell you something that you're going to find hard to believe. That church was in the state of Tennessee. So God took care of us. We went on through life. We went to a place far away. We were down there serving in some churches there. That congregation that showed us the door and told us we'll never be members here. Two times since then have asked me to come back and be the bishop of their congregation. That has happened twice since we were told to get out the door. That is something I did not see the day we were shown the street. You see, faith sees, though not with these eyes. We don't know how this is going to turn out. Third year drought was the worst one. Every year we rented more land. I rented land from Dr. Myers over on Hollis Springs Road. I rented land from Mrs. Whitty right across the road, joined the edge of the bluff from Moortown Store. We rented more land down the road with Mrs. Fan. Rented more land that third year than ever did before. Try to make up for the past losses. Planted that whole field down out there with corn, her whole farm. We planted with corn. The corn grew up as about a foot and a half tall, 18 inches tall. It was beautiful, dark green. It just was as even as could be. You thought someone did it by hand. And then the water turned off. I stood in that cornfield and I saw two things. I saw that every stalk in there was as brown as these benches or browner. Everything was dead. And the cracks in the ground, you could put your hand in up to your elbow. It was a Tuesday evening. I mean, that's natural eyes. That's what you can see, right? That's what you see. It'll never pay another loss, deeper in debt than ever. That's what you see. So we were having supper down in the Bullpen Creek. I told the family after supper we're all going to get the pickup truck. And we drove over to that field. I parked the truck along the road. We walked into the rows of these dead corn stalks and the cracks. And we knelt there on the ground and prayed. Then I told the family we're going to stand up. Before we go back home, we're going to sing a hymn. We're going to sing a hymn of praise here. And so we got together to try to sing. And my wife couldn't sing. She was crying. She started walking towards the truck. I followed her towards the truck. The four children stood there and sang this hymn. I could hear them singing as I walked out of the field towards the truck. I heard them back there, the little chorus of four people standing in a dry, dead field singing. That's all you could see. I had no idea what God was going to do with that field. Canyon County, Tennessee, 35, 36 years ago, 37, 8 years ago, what do you expect happens when Johnson grass grew up in that field? The Johnson grass got quite tall, and I told the boys to go out there with a hay bind, mow that Johnson grass down, bale it, and put it in the barn. And now, there's a farm sale. And now, the auctioneer looks at me and he says, "Mr. Heise, as far as I know, we've sold everything you have here that was on the sale bill." He said, "Is there anything else you know of that needs to be sold?" I said, "No, it's all gone." A man came running across the field through the crowd of people that were standing there and came up to the auctioneer. He said, "What's Mr. Heise going to do with all that Johnson grass that's up in the barn?" And the auctioneer looked at me and said, "Mr. Heise, did you know there's junk? What do you plan to do with the Johnson grass?" I said, "It's junk. It's worthless. We have nothing to do with it." He said, "Mr. Heise, these farmers have no feed for their cattle. These farmers are desperate. Would you please sell them those bales?" I couldn't believe the price that those bales brought. It wasn't worth a crop of corn. I took the money from that, sailed those bales, and drove to Indiana and bought a school bus. I brought the school bus back home. My son took the seats out of it and stacked them in the back of the bus, and we put a few things in there that we were going to keep, and we drove the school bus to Costa Rica. We unloaded our things down there and sold the school bus, and every cent that it cost us to move from Tennessee to Costa Rica was paid. It didn't cost me 1 cent to go to Costa Rica. And God knew all that when we were in the field, but I didn't. Why should this anxious load affect your weary minds in this way? You don't see it, but faith believes it. You don't need to believe what's going to happen. You can't tell that. You can't predict what God's going to do. But your eye is on Him. You know He's in charge of it. You know He will take care of it. He is for you. He's not against you. He will get you through this. He has a way to get through it. You don't need to see the reason. You don't need to know what He's going to do. You don't need to know that now. You will find it out. We do not only believe that God can work in us and take care of this. We do not only believe that God can do what we cannot do, but we believe something else. Listen closely. We also believe that God will do it. Not only that He can do it, that He will do it. We do not need to know when it will happen, but we know and we believe that it will happen, though we don't know how. Now, what are we doing while we're waiting? There's fellowship and there's encouragement and there's hope for us even now in the midst of this trial. That fourth man that was seen in the fiery furnace is just as available for you in your struggles as it was for them back there in theirs. In your present distress. So we returned out of that church down there. You're done here. And I was devastated. I didn't know what in the world to do. And I'm not saying that God's going to do this in your life. I'm going to tell you what He did in ours. This was nothing I predicted, nothing we planned, nothing, no stick in my hand would ever have accomplished this. But somehow or another, I don't know how it came to my ears, I heard that down in Chattanooga, Tennessee, right off of I-75, there was a little Bible missionary church down there, and they were going to have a week of revival meetings. I put the family in the car after we were milking here one night, and we drove down there, found that church, went in there, and Spencer Judson from Ward, Arkansas, the general secretary of the Bible Missionary Church nationwide, was preaching there. Those people received us in that church so very beautifully. They were so happy we came, we went the next night. Spencer Judson got in the pulpit, he said, "We're very, very happy to see our Mennonite friends here tonight." Before that week was over, I became dear friends with that man. It was tremendous encouragement for our family. It wasn't necessarily the kind of church that maybe we would have chosen to become part of, but at that moment, our children were so excited to have that experience. We went to Costa Rica. We were there 7 weeks, and one day the phone rang. We didn't have any phones out there where we lived, but there was a special patch set up that somebody in the community had a phone. It was the only phone in the whole geographic area there. Outside on the porch, there was a body covered with a sheet. Suzanne and I were sitting in the living room side by side on the couch. She looked at me and she said, "We knew it, didn't we, Daddy?" She was talking about the fact that she told me when he was 2 years old that we'll never be able to keep this boy. And she was right. But someone came running about that time and said, "Brother Dale, there's a phone call for you." I picked up the phone. "Yes, Dale, this is Spencer Johnson. I'm at home and I just got this word of what happened down there in Costa Rica, and I had to call you and talk to you about it." And he told me the experience he had with his 21-year-old daughter. My point is that in your distress and discouragement and adversity, there's help for you and encouragement and love and care. And God will not forsake you at the most difficult hour of your life. It is amazing what God can do. You can't plan it. You had no idea it was going to happen. But God cared about it. And God was not finished with you. God still has a plan for your life. There's still life to be lived. So you can thank and glorify God just like Paul and Silas did. They talk about adversity. It was unjust. They were in that prison. Can you imagine in your present distress, in your present adversities, and the difficulties you know people are going through, can you imagine the words of this song? I saw a wayward traveler in tattered garments clad and struggling up the mountain. It seemed that he was sad. His back was heavy laden. His strength was almost gone. Yet he shouted as he journeyed, deliverance will come. In palms of victory, crowns of glory, palms of victory I shall wear. And this song goes on and talks about that man's experience until he's finally carried by the angels on the other side of the flaming flood. He sees that city out there and shouts, deliverance has come. And there's tremendous power in that kind of faith. To sing those doxologies, to sing those vibrant hymns of victory and promise when everything to everybody else looks dark and impossible. But somehow there's something inside that says God cares for me right now and is working in ways I know nothing about. May I just say this and I'm soon done. You see in your life, dear brother, this morning, sister, the husbandman is pruning his vine. That's what's happening. He's perfecting your branch. He's going to make you more fruitful than you were. Yield to it. It's okay to accept it. You could ask yourself this question, dear God, what do you want me to learn from this experience? You can ask again, have I contributed something personally to my present distress? Do you think there's nothing to correct, nothing to improve in your own life? Do you feel that you're such the image of perfection that God has nothing to yet adjust and improve? To get more usefulness from your experience in life, even though you might be older than what you were? Would you allow others to be free to share what they see in your life, in my life? Are we open to that? How do we respond when others try to help us with what they think they see? Is this not God's opportunity room and not just a waiting room? Surely for you, for me, for all of us today, there is a practical answer for our present distress. You are not on a detour. Please, dear brothers and sisters, even now you're on victory's side. You're closer to it than what you think. So I would like to end with a couple of thoughts from Joseph. I'm not going to open my Bible. I'll just talk to you about Joseph a little bit. We're already acquainted with him. Joseph did not grab that staff. Yes, he used it, but not to spite rocks, not to defend himself. He didn't use his rod to set the record straight, to make sure the truth be known. How do you think about the injustices in Joseph's life, 13 years of it? And I want to end with sharing something with you that then leaves Joseph back in the pages of Genesis and takes the rod and puts it into your hand, where we're sitting this morning. The jealousy of 10 brothers amounts to nothing when God is with Joseph. No lording Potiphar, no Egyptian Pharaoh, no prison wall, no provocative woman, no 13 years of privation could hinder heaven's plan for Joseph's life. So the only one thing those things could do, get one step closer, one step closer. And when a butler forgets all about it for 2 years, never entered his mind squeezing the juice into his cup so the Pharaoh could drink it. None of these adversities, none of these climatic and traumatic experiences and injustices in Joseph's life for one moment hindered what God was doing in his life, nor can it hinder what God is doing in yours. Heaven's plan for Joseph's life, heaven's plan for your life and for mine. God was with Joseph. I'm asking you, do you have the assurance that God is with you this morning? That God cares about you and your needs and your struggles? Do you believe that God has an answer? He's already working it out. And how would that change our attitude if we would lay our staff down? Instead of screaming at the rebels and reminding them of the stress that they put you under, you would go to the rock and speak to the rock. And that rock is Christ. You would say, I know that you're for me and you have the answer for the situation. And no, I don't see it. I trust you. And Job said that though skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God, whom I shall see for myself and not another, though my reins be consumed within me. God is in charge. I will not lose my integrity. So in that little white building down there close to the highway, I was silenced there on a Saturday night by two bishops that came in, got the voice of the congregation. That's what they thought they should do. And I could not understand it. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't. Did I make mistakes as a preacher? Well, of course I did. But the preachers that were silencing me did too. They did also. But that was Saturday night. Monday morning, something very beautiful happened. And I believe it was McMinnville, Tennessee. I was up on a ladder doing some electrical work. Door had been down below. The owner of this building, a restaurant, a Sonic drive-in, came walking the door, looked up at me. And I could tell he wanted to talk to me, so I came down. He looked at me and he said, "Hey, Dale, what's wrong with you?" And I couldn't believe it that he could see it on my face. I didn't believe it that I had allowed that to affect me that much, that a stranger walking the door could see something written there that I didn't know was visible. And though he was an ungodly man, for some reason I just felt I should do it, and so I did. I told him the whole story. I told him what happened on Saturday night. I said, "I guess that's affecting me. I didn't think that it was." And he dropped his head. Everything was quiet. He looked up at me and he said, "Dale, that is tough stuff." And he dropped his head again. And I knew he wasn't finished. He looked me in the eyes and he said, "Dale, don't run. Stay right where you are. Wait. Don't run. I just felt that was God's leading. I felt that was God's word from me, from an ungodly man. Maybe a dumb ass speaking, perhaps. But I decided to obey those words. Years went by. I was preaching in a church quite a long distance from here, and I saw a stranger sitting over against the wall. I didn't know who it was. And when the third service was over, there were people that were praying, and there were some needs out there, and I was, this pulpit platform was much higher than this one, and the one of the ministers of the congregation and I were sitting on this edge with our feet dangling down, and he had his arms around me, and when I was trying to pray for him, because he was struggling, and when we got past that, and I looked up, and here the other preacher from the congregation was walking down with this stranger. They were coming down the aisle there towards the pulpit. And the brother said to me, do you know who this is? Well, I said, I'm sorry, I don't think I do. And about that time, memory kicked in, and I remembered that face. He was one of the two bishops that was down here in that white building on a Saturday night. He said, Brother Dale, I drove 120 miles tonight to come here. I had to come. I could not stay home. I came to tell you something. I never felt good about my participation. I shouldn't have done it. I'm sorry. I'm so glad to hear you preach tonight. Please be faithful, Dale. Keep it up. Keep going. I'm sorry. That man had a mission in Africa. Shortly after that, he went over to Uganda. Was sitting here behind the pulpit waiting for his turn to preach. And before he stood up to preach, he fell over and died right there. But that was my last interview with him. And God arranged for that to happen. Life is filled with stories like that. And what is the reason? Once yield to God. Put the staff in God's hand. Let him take care of your circumstances. Let him arrange the things. Let him show you what he plans to do. Not today, but believe it a while. And shout that deliverance will come. And with palms of victory and crowns of glory, the answer will soon be here. And you will live to see the goodness of our God.